listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing to look at the book, The Purpose Effect, Building Meaning in Yourself, Your Role, and Your Organization by Dan Pontefract. Last show, we were looking at sweet spot guidance. And the conclusion of that section was, to create an organizational declaration of purpose, the following techniques may be helpful. Embed stakeholders into the declaration, ensuring all applicable interest groups are addressed. Second, be succinct, specific, and jargonless, but ensure it is equally expressive. Make it relatable to both customers and team members. There are examples from organizations in machinery, grocery, and clothing that we can learn from as well, including John Deere. We are committed to serving those linked to the land, thereby helping to improve living standards for people everywhere. Whole Foods. Helping support the health, well-being, and healing of both people, customers, team members, and business organizations in general, and of the planet. Patagonia. Build the best product, cause no unnecessary harm, use business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis. Guiding tip. Serve all stakeholders. Of course, if an organization is going to create a declaration of purpose, it should also be prepared to serve all of its stakeholders. The importance of such a change is arguably best summarized by Frank Abrams, chairman of Standard Oil of New Jersey in the late 1940s and early 1950s. In a 1951 public address, Abrams remarked, quote, "The job of management is to maintain an equitable and working balance among the claims of the various directly affected interest groups, including stockholders, employees, customers, and of course the public at large. Business managers are gaining professional status partly because they see in their work the basic responsibilities to the public that other professional men have long recognized as theirs. Imagine that. The chairman of an oil company urging us to balance an organization's purpose against all the needs of stakeholders. There's a fairly easy way to summarize all of the stakeholders the organization ought to be serving. If it is putting its customers first, it does so through its team members, who are ideally engaged, demonstrating personal and role-based purpose, who then aim to assist the community in which they live and the society of which they are part of. Additionally, the organization will provide a return to owners and or stakeholders where applicable. Of course, this is an outcome of a properly aligned strategy that addresses the needs of other stakeholder groups before shareholders. These groups include customers, team members, community, society, then owners, shareholders, if applicable. To actually serve all stakeholders, a few more steps and considerations might be contemplated for each of these groups. Customers. Outline the importance of your customers by redesigning all organizational practices to prioritize and serve the customer first. Regardless of the business unit, objective, or geography, all team members must be aligned with the reason the organization exists in the first place. This ought to be the common DNA for all team members everywhere. Then, if you're not doing so already, survey your customer base regularly for insights and feedback. This sort of customer intelligence ensures the organization is meeting or exceeding customer service levels, but also aligns the entire organization with its organizational purpose. Mark Colgate, Associate Dean of the University of Victoria, suggests three key attributes to be continuously demonstrated and assessed: reliability, responsiveness, and relationship. An organization must be looked upon as reliable. Does what it commits to. It must be seen as responsive, meaning proactive versus reactive. And then relatable to the customer. As Mark said, quote, "It's about the warmth and wonder of the human conversation, even remembering the customer's name, giving them special attention, and asking questions so that you can get to know them even more." These three R's should become factors that help the organization determine whether it is indeed putting its customers first. Additional customer actions are detailed later. Team members. Whether directly or indirectly, any customer deserves to be served by an engaged team member. To offer an interaction between a team member and a customer that is unreliable, unresponsive, or failing to be relatable can often be pinpointed to a disengaged individual. But a team member equally deserves to work in an engaging, connected, collaborative, and open environment in their place of work. Anything less is a failure on behalf of the organization's senior leadership team to recognize the importance of team members and their contributions to its overarching mission. To create an organizational culture in which the majority of team members are engaged, it is possible to recommend putting into action these ideas contained within the first book in this series called Flat Army. This book aims to cultivate an environment that results in an unobstructed flow of corporate commonality. Flat Army is the simplest form, refers to the point at which all team members act as a unified corporate organism using clear and succinct goals. When an organization is united, such that duplication is negated and selfless amount of collaboration is the norm, when it no longer operates a culture of command and control, but rather one of engage and empower, it has become an open, engaged, and connected flat army. With a view specific to the purpose effect, some distinct organizational engagement actions are outlined below in and other guiding tips examples. Community. Jill Schenar is a staunch proponent of doing good in the community. Jill argues that, quote, "organizations need to think beyond profit and product and have a social mission or vision that makes their employees feel as if they are contributing to the greater good." She claims a team member's objectives must be tied back to the overall company mission, and they must have a clear understanding of how their activities impact the overall corporate performance and social mandate. The importance of Jill's observation is subtle, but important. As we've been detailing, the mission and mandate of the organization, in other words, its purpose, must be redefined and declared to involve all stakeholders. As we have discussed, it must then also include the community. What does that mean? Somewhat obviously, any organization operates and is located in a community. Perhaps it operates in several communities. multinationals can conduct business in hundreds of communities. Whatever the scenario, the organization must consider giving back to the community in which it operates, for the community is part of the organization's purpose. The easiest manner in which to serve the community is through organizational sponsorship of volunteering. This can manifest through labor, e.g. cleaning up garbage, compassion, e.g. donating time at a hospice, or intellect, e.g. teaching at a local school or retirement center. But, of course, any organization should also be earmarking a portion of its budget or revenues for the community, donating money on top of volunteer time. Most for-profit companies do give, but the question quickly becomes how much. The average giving since the early 1980s has amounted to 2% of pre-tax profits. Between direct financial giving and in-kind gifts, I argue that the percentage amount should be far greater. For public sector organizations, there really is nothing stopping them from attributing a small portion of their budget to further community causes. After all, public sector team members live in the community as well. Society. Take a moment to observe what you are currently wearing. Now picture the contents of your closet. What do you see? You may not know it, but the social impact on the production of clothes is often harming our society and our planet. In Tirupur, India, research found dyeing and bleaching units from local garment factories were generating 87 million liters of untreated wastewater per day, most of it dumped into the Noyar River. Not surprisingly, locals have reported large increases in health defects and other immune issues. In Bangladesh, 4 million garment workers across the country make less than $100 a month each in wages. Cotton farmers in Africa and Central America use pesticides with faulty or dated equipment, while pickers, including children, are exposed to these toxins, ingesting the poison and suffer from forms of malady thereafter. The garment industry is one example of how we are detrimentally affecting society in our quest for profit and or power, among other organizational inanities. Emissions, pollutants, water utilization, electricity consumption, and other environmental factors cannot continue to be treated as greenwashed promises. As it considers all of its stakeholders, the organization likewise must prioritize improvements in the way it treats our physical society. Fairphone and G-Diapers are excellent examples of organizations getting it right. Next, an organization must ensure its labor practices are fair and ethical. Whether onshore or abroad, how an organization treats its team members, contractors, suppliers, or partners must become better than today's practices. Safe and healthy work environments are a must. Fair living wages are another absolute. This type of factors ought to be targeted, tracked, and made publicly available. I discussed this tactic in the Purpose Effect Scorecard, supplied later. Owners and shareholders. Lynn Stout argues in her book, The Shareholder Value Myth, quote, many people are pro-social, meaning they're willing to sacrifice at least some profits to allow a company to act in an ethical and socially responsible fashion. She adds, quote, others care only for their own material returns. To achieve this, it is going to take serious courage and gumption on the part of senior leaders to eliminate the latter and improve the former. A profit is obviously required for a for-profit organization to stay in business. But how much is enough? Of course, as history has demonstrated, and I have shown here, increased profits and revenues upheld at all costs, including team member layoffs and other unethical acts, are tied to stock market price gaming and stock option rewards. William Lazionik pointed this out in a Roosevelt Institute white paper when he wrote, quote, this toxic combination of stock market manipulation, stock-based pay as incentive, etc., is at the core of the failure of the U.S. economy to achieve stable and equitable economic growth. There have been so many opponents to this adage. Quote, maximizing shareholder value, backing up Roger L. Martin's thesis in his book Fixing the Game, What to Do? The problem, sadly, is far too complex to unravel in this book. But more guidance comes from Charles G. Koch, chairman and CEO of Koch Industries. He has gone on record as never having been guided by the maximization of profit, rather the creation of value. Koch wrote in his book, Good Profit, quote, our vision is based on what we believe is the role of business and society, providing products and services that customers want more than their alternatives, while more effectively using resources. Consequently, we strive to profit only from benefiting both our customers and society as a whole. The pursuit of profit must be balanced by the benefits derived by customers and broader society as well. Maximizing shareholder value is not a goal, rather is an outcome of a purpose-driven organization. As Roger L. Martin previously outlined, perhaps stock options and restricted stock units should simply be eliminated as features of the compensation portfolio in favor of actual cash awards. For each of the five stakeholders an organization now aims to serve, I recommend setting targets and then publicly publishing the results to a new dashboard website. This is not a corporate social responsibility document or report. It is a thoroughly defined and proactive set of targets and measures that are established, which the organization holds itself accountable to on a quarterly and annual basis. CSR documents tend to be reactive and too often toothless. A cumulative score or target can be created from all targets measured against all stakeholders, one we will coin the Purpose Effect Scorecard. This is applicable for public sector, not-for-profit, and for-profit entities as well. An inability to meet the overall targets will not result in lip service either, but genuine penalties. How? The easiest penalty might be adjusting remuneration. If an organization is publicly traded, part of the punitive measure ought to be related to a decreased level of RSUs, or restricted stock units, and or stock option awards. Various governance protocols could only be put in place to ensure this occurs. The penalties might be applicable to not only senior leaders. The resulting effect would not result in previously issued RSUs or stock options being rescinded. Rather, a lower allotment being made available in the pool for that year. That seems both fair and ethical. Taking it a step further would be to, as mentioned earlier, eliminate any type of RSU or stock option award in favor of a cash bonus pool. This may stop executives and boards from gaming the stock market system and the fabrication of stock price volatility. For more information, read the book Fixing the Game, that goes into more details here. If an organization has either profit-sharing pools, annual bonus pools, or annual salary increase pools, with the latter occurring in any type of organization, these two could be earmarked for penalties, or even better, for rewards. For example, if targets are set and are met or exceeded, accordingly, the organization can reward team members at all levels for a job well done, with increased outcomes that financially benefit all team members. The program does not have to be thought of as only punitive in nature. Perhaps the organization could take things even farther, with additional benefits being applied to the community if results were positive. I imagine how motivated the team members would become if the organization commits to donating more of its profits to the community if the targets were met. Imagine how the reputation of the organization could increase in the eyes of customers and community citizens. Imagine how that may positively impact customer satisfaction and, in some cases, revenues or profits. The targets that are set annually and then tracked quarterly and publicly published ought to include the following. customers. Customer satisfaction scores through various factors, including reliability, responsiveness, and relationship. Other metrics could also be devised by the organization. Team members, engagement scores and sub-drivers, diversity breakdown, acts of internal recognition, positional changes, promotions and learning and development expenditures. Community, team member, volunteer hours, organizational philanthropic investments, in-kind donations, number of community members impacted, etc. Society, CO2 and greenhouse gas or GHG reductions, water utilization and reuse, energy consumption, redesign, material consumption lessening. Other examples from Dow Jones Sustainability Indices or DJSI could also be utilized. Owners and shareholders. Applicable to for-profit firms. Profitability, revenue, and shareholder returns if publicly traded, but all metrics set to levels that are appropriately fair. Each stakeholder holds a 20% share of the overall scorecard. In the case of a public sector or not-for-profit organizations, the first four stakeholder groups are utilized, each accounting for a 20% share. But the finer stakeholder might be renamed budget, ensuring the organization does not overspend. Each of the measured categories found within each stakeholder can be broken down by percentage weight. For example, under community, the organization determines how many hours it should be volunteering, its community investment level, and amount of in-kind donations. These are raw values, but the three categories, and others if it chooses, are then broken down by a weighting. Perhaps volunteering holds a 50% weight, whereas community involvement and in-kind donations are rated at 25% each. Whatever gets reported then feeds the 20% category of community when it feeds the overall score of the purpose effect. When the organization achieves its overall target for the year, that is the point when other incentives kick in. For example, the purpose effect scorecard for the for-profit organization can be outlined in a detailed table. And since this is an oral program, we won't get into this table, but essentially summarizes everything that we just said. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the purpose effect, building meaning in yourself, your role, and your organization by Dan Pontefract. We're on the section sweet spot guidance. Next section, guiding tip, delight and deliver value to your customers. Regardless of its makeup, an organization exists for its customers. As we have discussed, an organization's purpose is not to drive shareholder value uniquely, even though that is important, for that is an outcome of delivering sound customer value. An organization's purpose is not to uphold power or to command and control team members either. The organization ought to be initiating and committing to a strategy that ensures it is putting customers first. Whether the organization is for profit, not for profit, or public sector, securing and serving a customer, delivering value throughout the entirety of the relationship, is the only reason an organization really exists. Customers are the primary stakeholders. An organization ought to embed all facets of its customer-first paradigm into as many outlets as possible, including learning and development, community investment, recognition practices, recruitment, succession planning, performance development, as well as all communication channels and methods. It is highly advantageous to embed the customer's first strategy into all go-to-market processes as well. For example, marketing, supply chain, partnering, etc. It takes time, but once the organization makes the decision to put the customer first, all practices are in need of being rewired, redeveloped, and reconciled due to pre-existing norms and processes. In addition to the organizational declaration of purpose, a corresponding set of customer-first values and behavioral attributes should also be developed. These new and updated values and attributes become the basis on which team members and the organization operate with one another, delighting and serving the customer. When the customer is put first, the organization more easily can rally around common cause. While organizations like Qualify, Lightspan Digital, and Etsy have the benefit of being relatively young firms that establish their customer-first, service-oriented culture from their inception, that does not mean that older organizations cannot alter their operating practices and put customers first as well. By way of example, TELUS, which dates from 1880, developed 11 value attributes in the year 2010. These focused on its customer-first strategy launched in the same year. In 2012, it then developed customer-first commitments that further align behavior to customer interaction expectations. Both of these were created through hundreds of team member focus groups, online discussions, and contributions. It might have taken longer to achieve the end result, but it created an earlier level of team member engagement and buy-in. The customer-first commitments that TELUS eventually introduced included: first one, we take ownership for every customer experience. Second, we work as a team to deliver on our promises. Third, we learn from customer feedback to take action to get better every day. And fourth, we are friendly, helpful, and thoughtful. And in the next show, we'll bring this book to a conclusion and we'll summarize the concluding comments. So thank you for listening and we'll see you in the next show.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Radio Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints on this week.